Well, here we are, another day in the podcast table. Since yesterday, you've been talking about this case with Mike Ashley versus Morgan Stanley. What all this is about, because I've seen you today, like, you know, literally not talking to me at all. but that's the reality. And you've been talking about this case. And, like, you know,
we slightly made a roll for our own backs.
We're feeling lonely, Alexandra.
I felt a teeny tiny bit.
Okay.
I'm not going to lie.
All right. Well.
So, yeah, share with me and with the world what all this is about.
Yeah, well, I've clearly got very excited about this case because I think it's a really has so many implications for, you know, the people that we help, you know, in the control functions,
mm-hmm.
because it actually is a wonderful example. And that's, you know, that's such a thing, Damien, about our business, isn't it? Is that, you know, we work with audit before problems happen, you know, trying to prevent them.
Yeah.
You know, we help investigators. That's the biggest part of our business, investigations. Not that much bigger than audit, but it's certainly bigger. When, you know, problems are alleged or people are trying to, you know, dig into problems, find out what's going wrong or what has gone wrong, what they suspect may be wrong. And then, you know, the other part of our business is expert witness, where we help on cases just like this, where it calls for expert evidence and, you know, for the courts, it can be difficult to understand what's happening. And also there's a context of, you know, outside of contractual stuff, what are the practices, what are the procedures within financial institutions? And that's why, you know, we often help because we have such a good insight into all these different areas and aspects.
Yeah.
Right. So, and this case also, I think for us, it is also interesting. And bear with me here because I'm now going to sort of compare Mike Ashley to Nigel Farage, but it's not quite the same. And I might get sued or he might like that. I don't know. But we were saying towards the end of last year, one of our calls was that one of the big areas of risk for financial institutions, particularly on the sell side, in light of what happened with Farage and the debanking situation, was that you have this risk now, and I think it's a raised risk within financial institutions that you have so many forums, so many decision-making forums around so many aspects of your business. And the problems really arise when your customers find out actually the reasons that were presented to them are not necessarily the same as the internal discussions within the institution. And there's a bit of that kind of ingredient in this case as well, but there are others too.
Yeah, there's, I mean, as we said in our piece towards the end of last year, it's all, they can be internal chats or they can be minutes from meetings, but things are discussed there that maybe you wouldn't expect to see the light of day, but might under a freedom of information request or some such. So I think the point of our piece was it just, we felt it would be an area that people should be looking at, even though this case is actually occurs back in 2021, this alleged case. You know, absolutely, it's definitely front and centre how stuff is recorded and where it's recorded, how accessible it might be, etc.
And, you know, this all kind of, I guess, hit the kind of, you know, or drew my attention in that article that you found in the Times. Obviously, you found it. It was a big article. It's, you know, but that article has a lot of potentially, I think, you know, sensitive, embarrassing information. We don't know the source for that information. It could be that it's already come out in the UK court proceedings because actually this has been in the court for, you know, a little bit of time.
Yeah.
But the point is that I think next week this hits the High Court and it really becomes, you know, quite the potential for, you know, quite a lot of scrutiny around some of the practices. But let's set the tone for everyone, Damien, because really this all kicks off in May 2021.
Yeah.
But it possibly has its foundation earlier in the year. So why don't you talk through what happens in January 2021? And obviously you've got things like GameStop. We're in, you know, also cast your mind back. We're in in lockdown.
Yeah, so I mean, I thought that's what you were plotting at, actually, was more the sort of the COVID type. We had this big sell-off, if people remember, back in March of that year, and then bounce. But within that, there were a lot of, you know, we saw the meme stock frenzy, as it was called, with GameStop, you know, which went from whatever it was, $17 up to, what was it, $500 or something?
There was a pre-market level of 500, and that was, you know, in the space of a month, I think.
Yeah.
Which is, that's a, you know, 2,800% increase, 28 times. Yeah. That's terrifying stuff. Well, that's one context.
We'll come back to that number later. And the other is the Archegos scandal, which was a family office building up super large positions with multiple prime brokers that were, he was collateral called on. So he built up these big positions. I think each prime broker assumed that they were the only ones with a position, nobody else had an issue, so that they could sort of felt that they were manageable. And I can't remember who it was that blinked first, but one of them sort of saw that there was a problem there, started to offload these positions, called the collateral, and then just started to offload the positions. And there was a sort of waterfall down in some quite big names, mostly US-based, I think, if I recall. And I think that the total loss, they reckon, was around the $8 billion across the...
So yeah, there was a few estimates. I mean, in terms of the people who moved first, I think Goldman moved pretty quick. That's, I think, right. Deutsche moved pretty quick and had pretty, you know, de minimis losses. Morgan Stanley, who are the subject of this case, actually reported on the 16th of April, because there was a missed margin called 26th of March,
yeah,
2021. By the 16th of April, Morgan Stanley had actually reported that they had a near billion loss,
yeah,
from this. Now, that sounds horrific. But actually, people like Nomura and Credit Suisse lost
Credit Suisse
a lot
was
more.
Obviously, the famous one that really did.
And it contributed probably to bringing them down. But also Nomura heavily hit as well. The Wall Street Journal produced a number estimating $8 billion in 10 days.
Okay, right, that was good.
And then Bloomberg, you know, not to be outdone, came out with $20 billion in 2 days. So you know, some fantastic numbers being bandied around. But you can sort of see the tension in all of this and the embarrassment as well, actually, to allow such a kind of, you know, a hole to be blown into banks' balance sheets as a result of activities. You know, this does get everyone, you know, I think, moving and, you know, jittery inside the firms.
Yeah. Sorry, just to actually go back, I was saying that the sell-off occurred in 21. It didn't. The big market sell-off was 20. But obviously, a lot of these retail-type stocks having collapsed, and then the market rebounded. A lot of these retail stocks didn't really rebound.
Yeah.
So by beginning of 21, some of these were down at the lows that they'd seen from the 2020 COVID sort of sell-off. So that's sort of, I suppose, painting a picture of where we are.
Well, and this is where the story begins for Fraser Group, doesn't,
yeah,
it, with Hugo Boss. And that's what this is about. It's a Hugo Boss position.
Yeah.
And Fraser Group started building a position in Hugo Boss.
Yeah, we're not exactly sure when, but they first make an RNS, which is a sort of UK regulatory disclosure, in, I think, June of 2021. So they've... No, sorry, June of 2020.
Yeah.
Apologies. And they've built a position... In a few of the ordinaries and some contracts for difference, but mostly by selling puts. So I think their total position at that point is around the 5% mark, including that put position.
Now, at this point, people might start getting a bit, oh my God, what was selling puts?
Yes.
What's going on? So I think we can help and just clearly explain what this is, right? So if you're selling puts to someone, you're taking in premium.
Correct.
You're receiving for those puts. You're giving someone else the right to sell you stock,
yeah,
at a predefined price.
Yes.
And if the stock falls below that, say it's whatever, let's say it's 30, and the stock falls to 20, you're on the hook to pay 30 if they exercise those options.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, in the case of Fraser Group, think about that from their position. It's always good to think about the motivation of any customer as to why they're doing something, or any market counterpart. If they were going to build a position in Hugo Boss and announce to the market that they were building a position in Hugo Boss, the stock would go up.
Yeah.
So actually, for them to sell puts and end up paying a slight premium if they got exercised, it kind of makes sense. Because actually, they've got a kind of known cap on the stock price.
Correct, yeah. No, it can be quite a useful way to build a position. To start with, was a relatively small position. And if you think, you look at the Hugo Boss chart, you know, it had been up in the sort of 50, 60, 80 euro range back in 2020. And it had really fallen. It was trading around the 20 euro level there. So it's come off a long way by that point. And so, you know, we don't know the full reasons, but we know Mike Ashley's a pretty shrewd operator, and he's probably going, this, you know, this business is going to be okay. It's going to survive. Maybe I'll have a bit of that action. You know, I'm happy to start to build a position. And actually, a lot of the announcements he made alongside that was it was just strategic holding. He wasn't necessarily looking to go, I'm going to buy this whole thing and take it private and just eat it up myself. But this
strategy of, you know, selling puts, they do it in other stuff. You know, Currys have done it in. I think ASOS have done it in. You know, it's pretty common for them to do. They're not, you know, and I think this is also an interesting aspect of any case. Is you often wonder about what the sophistication and expertise of either side is, because clearly Morgan Stanley Investment Bank, you know, very, very able. We should mention as well that there's Saxo, the Danish bank/broker, in the mix in here as well. But we'll talk about that probably in a second. But just to sort of talk about, you know, their motivation. So they've been building this position.
Yeah.
But they end up actually, in fact, selling calls.
Yes. So most of the position building up until this point has been buying just the outright ordinaries or contracts for difference, which amount to the same thing, and selling these put positions. But actually what's happening as 2021 winds on a bit, the Hugo Boss price is starting to appreciate quite significantly. So it's moved from around the 20 euro level to more like 40 euros. And then as we run into this sort of key date, which is, in fact, the 25th of May of 21, the stock is really starting to motor and has moved from sort of 35 to 45 in the course of a couple of weeks. And it's become clear in some of the documentation we've seen around this, public documentation, I used to add, that they have switched as well as being a put seller to being a call seller.
Yeah.
And in a way, as we discussed before this, that sort of makes sense in a way, because you've got a position that's now starting to make you money. You know, you've built up a position, it's sort of doubled in value. And actually a way to then start to possibly realize some of that would be to start selling calls, because if the stock carries on going, you have the exposure yourself anyway. So you're just taking in premium from a position that you hold in the underlying. You know, it's a way that you can just... You can make that position do some work for you. You know, you can. You know, you're happy if the stock carries on going up and up and up. Well, you're very happy because you own it. But if it's not really going to do much, you think it's sort of bounced, it's doubled in price, and then it's sort of hit a level. You think, well, if I can sell some calls, I'm just going to bring in that premium, and you know, if nothing happens, I'll just keep doing that again and again and again. So what
you're essentially doing is you're allowing someone else to pay you.
Yep.
A level for the stock, and they're much more likely to exercise that call as the price increases, and effectively they get to buy the stock cheaper than the market price.
Yes.
But let's put ourselves in the shoes of Fraser Group.
Yeah.
They have, by this point, we don't know, but we think, you know, from the chart, looks like they've probably doubled their money.
Mm.
If they were to turn around, and we do know, and this is the other thing, Damien, is they're very open, aren't they? They're not hiding anything. The RNSs are there. They are declaring in their numbers what the implied percent stake they have in Hugo Boss, which I think at this point is approaching 30%.
Yes, that's right.
So it's a pretty hefty slug. If they were going to turn around to an investment bank and say, hey, help me sell this stake in Hugo Boss, we're not going to take it over. We were strategic, but you know what? We've made so much money on this.
Yeah.
We'd like to sell it. That's going to be a block trade, right? If you're going to sell that through equity, that's going to be a block trade.
Mm.
And you're an equity trader. You're an equity guy. That equals discount, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And the danger of it being leaked, you know, leaked information leakage. So the discount that you might be getting might end up being a lot worse, because if there's a leak and then you sort of go ahead and trade, you know, you might find that the sort of, I don't know what the standard would have been, 2-4% discount, suddenly, you know, it's moved 5% lower and now you're selling it at 3% discount. You know, that can be, you know, problematic.
And it's fees. Yes. You've got to pay some horrible investment banker a load of fees for their services.
Yes.
When all you want to do is just get out of this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, or potentially. Whereas as here, you have a predefined set of levels mm-hmm. that you know you're going to get that level for your stock, possibly. Just as an ex-convertible bond guy, of course, if you did decide to issue a convertible bond up there, then you could perhaps have achieved a premium.
Yeah.
One of the wonderful things about convertible bonds.
You're selling them anymore. I know. Anyway, it's worth a go, I suppose.
Absolutely, absolutely. But that, so that's, and it's this position, it's this short call position, which by May, and it's the 25th of May. So you and I found out, and Alexandra pointed out to us what is the Monday, the 24th of May. What is that?
Whit Monday.
Whit Monday.
In Greece, we're calling it Aiupneumatos.
There you go. Look at that.
I can't spell that, but anyway.
Skadi, proudly multilingual. Skadi, proudly multilingual. Thank you for that. That's wonderful. So you get to the Tuesday after Whit Monday, 25th of May. And there's a decision. This, we're getting this from court papers and from newspaper articles for a margin call.
Yeah.
Now, why don't we tell people a little bit about the margin call? What sort of size are we talking about, Damien? What size is the position?
Well, exactly. I was going to say. So the position, we're going to be slightly annoying here and flipped between euros and dollars, but not that they were quite one to one at the time. I think they was 1 to 1.2. But the position size was 217 million euros.
Okay.
At sort of market price. And then the margin call in dollars, just to confuse things slightly, was just shy of $1 billion. So $995 million. So
hang on. That, just to point out, on the 16th of April, Morgan Stanley did report that they'd lost $1 billion, roundabout, I think it was 900 and change, from the Arcadis situation.
Yeah.
Probably just coincidence, but I just throw that in there, Damien, as a reference. As a reference.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, so it's a huge margin call, which starts to sort of set the cat amongst the pigeons. You mentioned Saxo earlier in the discussion. I suppose this is where they are slightly drawn in, because the Mike Ashley of Frasers Group position is not actually directly with Morgan Stanley. They are a client of Saxo, and Saxo hold their shares and also are helping them write these options. And then they are passing some of these options through to Morgan Stanley, certainly on the call side of things. As they sell these calls, they're back-to-backing these against Morgan Stanley. So this is where this was
Saxo. And that's because this is Hugo Boss. It's a German stock. Yeah. And Morgan Stanley are a Eurex member.
Correct.
German exchange, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's why they're using Morgan Stanley, we understand from court papers.
Yes. But the key thing around this, actually, if you sit in Saxo's shoes, is that they're not demanding any margin from Frasers Group because they hold the underlying shares. So because they, let's say, own 1 million shares, I think it's a fair few more than that, but if then they write 1 million's worth of calls, there's no margin call on that, because if the stock keeps on going up, well, you've got the underlying shares that you can settle that trade against. So yeah, you'd exactly deliver them. That's exactly what I'm looking for.
So, Damien, is Morgan Stanley looking for margin prior to this from Saxo?
From what we can see, no, they weren't. So,
and what does that imply to you? And we're implying stuff, right? We don't have first-hand access to any of the information. We're just using our knowledge and making a lot of assumptions, aren't we? And we should be clear to anyone listening to the podcast about what we're doing here. We're trying to set a team, but then ultimately we're going to talk about, you know, things that we think matter to our customers.
So in the US court filings, they said that the margin was de minimis, as in it was all that was required by Eurex to hold that position. In other words, the assumption would be that Saxo, who were selling these calls on behalf of them, passing them through to Morgan Stanley, we're saying to them, listen, don't worry, because this collateral is covered, that we have the shares underneath this. So there's no need to start margining us a huge amount, because we can always deliver the shares in against it. So
and you and I know that that's not a gentlemanly conversation.
No.
You know, people don't just take stuff at face value. Saxo, we think, must have evidenced to Morgan Stanley somehow
that
this stuff was covered. Now, whether they revealed or kept Frasers Group, didn't reveal that it was Frasers Group behind, we don't know.
No.
And we can't say one way or another. But we do know that certainly Frasers Group haven't been secretive about any of this. It's all in their filings what their position is.
Yeah, and this is a pretty sizable position that is being built up in a short call position.
And as a trader at Morgan Stanley or any bank, you tend to know. I mean, if you want to be a really good trader, you need to understand the motivation of what your customer's doing.
Correct.
And why they're doing
it. Or even not your customers, but where positions lie in the market.
Where positions lie in the market, and also when you're trading a stock, what is happening and why.
Hmm.
And you have a big position being built up in Hugo Boss. I don't know whether the Morgan Stanley traders knew about this or not. I think you and I, when we were trading, would have known pretty well the universe that we were trading and why. You don't always know what's happening, but that's your job.
Yeah.
You know, that's your job. I just make that comment to anyone in the control function trying to understand the kind of the backdrop around all of this stuff, right? So they've come up with, and well, this is the question. Come up with. I've pretty let the cat out of the bag, Damien. they've asked for really what is a very big margin call.
Yes, I mean 217 million
up to $900 million.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big amount of margin on an options position. What does that say about, or the court papers tell us what that infers about what Morgan Stanley is saying is going to happen?
Yeah, so
to the Hugo Boss stock price
is trading wherever it is around sort of 50-ish at this 40-50-ish at its time. So they're sort of saying, well, it could get to four times this. So we're talking the sort of 200 euro level, and they're using that as the level to demand a margin call.
Well, we don't know that so much because it's from the strike of the options. True. We don't know where the strike of the options is, but we're inferring, because we're intelligent. we can't embarrass ourselves when it all comes out. But what we're saying is we're trying to understand why now, right? Because you're always trying to understand the motivation. What is it about Whit Monday and Morgan Stanley deciding to do this to suddenly get agitated? And what we can see is a very big move in the stock at this point. So we wonder whether, don't we, that possibly strikes are around, or things have got sensitive around strike at this point.
Well, you'd think so, because for Frasers Group to be selling miles out of the money calls, you know, you're not going to bring any premium. So it's sort of, you have to assume that you're starting to approach certain call strike levels, just because they are going to start flashing up on risk systems. You know, if it's still at 200 or 100 euros, you know, double the price where you're trading now, you know, that a move of a couple of euros the week before isn't going to really make any difference. So the assumption is there are flags starting to be raised. And you've got to remember, as you said, why we set the scene. We had Archegos, you know, pretty close in the rearview mirror. And there's got to be a lot of discussions internally about making sure that risk is really kept on top of at this point. You know, we've seen it before. You know, you don't blow a hole it somewhere and then just go, oh, carry on doing anything you feel like on that desk. You know,
And to contextualise, we do see that there are comments in the press at the time with, is it Gorman from Morgan Stanley talking? And that there's definitely an emphasis on trying to reassure the market that controls are good inside the bank.
Yep.
And also, in particular, controls around family office.
Yes.
Right? And that's interesting because the inference in this case is that Frasers Group and their position this is some kind of family office. But of course, we can see all of this stated in the annual report of the Frasers Group.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting sort of juxtaposition, isn't it? Because, you know, Mike Ashley has a big position in Frasers Group, but this is the group, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, yes, absolutely. So I think there was pushback, as you say, against family offices who are, you know, by their nature, quite sort of opaque structures. And this was the whole point about Archegos, is that really knew what they were doing and or realised that he'd built up multiple prime brokerage agreements with various different counterparties. So they were definitely, family offices were definitely a place that there would be a lot of scrutiny on at that point in time.
So this is I can go all sorts of directions with this. And maybe directions is an interesting one, which I'll throw it to Alexandra at this point.
Okay.
Because immediately what this has made me think is I know what I'm like as a man in the car.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm driving and we get lost, I can't turn around. I just can't. I have to keep going forward in order to kind of go around,
right,
to turn around. And I almost wonder if this is what's happened inside Morgan Stanley, where they've started down this road of family office and then, but they can't change direction. And then there's something else happening, then they can't change direction. And they're almost sort of, because they just can't change direction on something, they've ended up where they are. But that's probably getting ahead of the story, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, in terms of coming of arriving at this massive margin call amount, because, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, this is a very large amount of money to ask anyone for, and obviously Frasers Group employs 30,000 people in the UK, so this is serious stuff.
Yeah,
this is serious stuff. We can see from the UK proceedings, because there were UK proceedings or have been UK proceedings, that this has been derived from something called the Jumped Health Stress Test.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard of that before. And you explained to me what on earth this could be, and it all makes sense now.
So the best way to, I suppose, is it's the inverse of a jump to default stress test.
Right, and that makes sense, because that's really what, you know, as a bond trader, what I'd care about.
I
jump to default.
What it comes down to is, if you've always got to remember, in a capital structure, the equity is the sort of smallest slither at the top of the capital structure, but therefore it is the most volatile. So if you think that a stock is anywhere near default, that equity is going to be almost worthless or completely worthless.
Right.
And if a company... I'm not casting this aspersion at all, because I'm not really sure of the ins and outs of the Hugo Boss capital structure. But if there was, you know, post-pandemic, a lot of these retailers are perceived to be in trouble. You know, if there's a thought that there is danger within the capital structure and its credit was not good, the equity would be wiped out. So the jump to default would be the fact that basically you're in your absolute nightmare scenario, this equity is just going to be worthless. But on the reverse of that, if suddenly things start to improve, the equity position could suddenly be worth a lot more than it's being priced in the market.
And we're short calls. I say we.
Yeah, yeah.
The concern here is the customer is short calls, and
this could be a massive re-rating of the stock.
And of course, we know that the retail sector is in an oversold position, right? We haven't got a crystal ball particularly, but obviously we've got the benefit of hindsight sitting in 2024. But at that point, you know, there probably is some jitters around, you know, the upside risk, I suppose.
Well, and going back to the very beginning of this conversation, as you clearly and cleverly laid out GameStop, which had only happened a couple of months before.
January.
You know, that had 28 bagged.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
the little guy.
And actually, you know, it is a retailer, theoretically, GameStop was back then.
So yeah, that's an interesting thought. That's an interesting
thought. Sort of vaguely trying to thread a story. But, you know, so I suppose to go, a stock's going to go 4x up is possible. I suppose you would argue.
There is, when you put it in that context, you can sort of see things. And what we should always remember, and I think this is so important, you know, for our investigative work, is you absolutely have to put yourself in the shoes of the people at the time.
Yeah.
You know, we sit here with all the benefit of hindsight, and hindsight's a terrible trap. And it's so important to put yourself and say, look, objectively, this is what I'm looking at the time. These are the practices in the market. This is the backdrop. How do these people feel? Yep. You know, how would I feel, you know, in the bank where I was at that time, or the bank I know at that time? You know, and that's the kind of benchmarking that we do when we turn up in an investigation, and you've got someone from Goldman, someone from UBS, someone from ING, you know, helping another bank, and you've got all that contextualization, and, you know, likely they were trading at the time on some of the historical stuff that we've done. It's invaluable because you have to put yourself in that situation to give anyone, you know, the fair hearing on this. You can't assume stuff, and hindsight is terrible for making you assume stuff about what could have happened. So talking about this, so we have the jump to health stress test. And in the UK proceedings, this was in line with Morgan Stanley standard practices.
Yes, that's what
right. I mean. But then we see in the US proceedings, and they've done a request for information to the US court. In fact, they make a point that there is no written policy or procedure around how margin calls should be issued and, you know, valued,
yeah,
etc. And that's really stark, isn't it? That's really interesting.
Because I had a very quick look at the CBOE website regarding how you would margin a short call or put position, and it tends to say that, you know, the value of the premium plus 10-15% of the underlying. So, you know, nothing like the number we're seeing here. You know, the on 10% of the 200 million euro position, that would be a sort of 20 million euro margin call. So just to give some sort of context of how that number has been arrived at, I mean, it's...
Well, I think we see this in a lot of other things, don't we? And the regulators, just to sort of, I guess, digress a little bit, because this isn't at all about consumer duty, really. These are big entities up against each other. But it's coming out in consumer duty, isn't it? And that's a big thing for the UK now, and what the FCA is doing, is that the FCA wants to look at things like valuation. How have you arrived at a valuation? Is it fair?
Yeah.
And being able to evidence valuation. And it does seem in this situation, if I'm sitting there in Fraser's Group or Saxo, and I'm being presented with a number. I mean, Saxo, I think from what we can read, are pretty shocked by the number. They do immediately cough up 400 million though. So there is, you know, there is a payment. They try and pass through an amount of 900 million to Fraser's, as well, because they, you know, they're just doing what they can to get this situation sorted out. But it does, you know, to my mind, you know, you can think about, well, there's obviously this implied rally in the stock, but also, you know, these are options positions. So is there some kind of jump in the volatility in the model? I don't know. You know,
we don't know.
And it must be so hard for a customer sitting there to, you know, understand how numbers have been arrived at. And I think that's something that you know, if you're in audit, you know, asking your front office, well, how do you evidence this to a customer? And if a customer challenged this, what would we do? Because there's also confidentiality. I know people, you know, do have their proprietary models, and there's, you know, but how much transparency should you be giving to a customer? I think that transparency is very, very important. It's very good. Understand that, you know, there's times when you maybe cannot be, or you try to protect that because of the market that you're transacting in. But that to me is an interesting area here. And in terms of the US proceedings, it seems that two individuals in the business unit risk division arrive at the number. And as we say, but, you know, this happens on the 25th of May. But the next day, Saxo have paid 400 million and tried to pass through 900 million. We also know on the 26th of May that Fraser's have written and announced. We've had an announcement, didn't we?
They announced the stock exchange that they're making no intention to make a bid for Hugo Boss. There's obviously a lot of rumour, I assume, starting to float around the market. So they've come out just to definitively nip that in the bud. But, you know, they are now scrabbling around to work out what to do. And in fact, some, I can't remember which press it is in, but Mike Ashley pledges 100 million sterling, I think it is, plus his entire Frasers Group stake to cover as collateral against that, plus the holding that he has in Hugo Boss.
Yeah, so this happens on Friday the 28th.
Oh, sorry,
he calls them up. No, but that's right. He calls them up in the evening, calls Morgan Stanley, and makes this sensational offer, which is sterling. It's not even dollars. Yeah. We're in another currency, DT. You know, but it's huge because it's 2 billion sterling, effectively. The stake in Frasers, £100 million in cash. And then the value of the Hugo Boss stake on top of that as well.
Mm.
And that's, I mean, that's a real commitment, I think. Obviously, yeah, all right, okay, kind of understand that you're trying to pledge in a margin call equity and there's a haircut for equity. So I can understand that, you know, on the face of it, we're saying, oh, it's 2 billion. Of course, you know, if you put 2 billion of treasuries, 2 billion of treasuries, if you put up equity, it's not the same.
Yeah.
But it's still a huge commitment. And, of course, there is this note that he's affirmed his support for the board at Hugo Boss, because there seems to have been some concern about whether he would turn activist as well. And it's at this point in the story that there's the appearance, from what we can read in the press, and I have to stress it's the press, really, that there's a change in position presented to the customer.
Mm.
I.e., up to this point, it's a financial situation, right? It's all about the amounts involved and the concern over the exposure of the position.
Yeah.
And at this point, it starts to flip now to be about not wanting to have the relationship with Frasers Group at Morgan Stanley, from what we can read in the press.
Yeah.
And there is a bit of back history to that, isn't there, Damien? Because earlier in the year, they had directly tried to
set up an account.
Set up a relationship from I think January of that year, which, you know, went through a lot of conversations, and it's these kind of conversations that have found their way into the press report.
Yes.
I don't know, maybe they were in the UK proceedings. We haven't managed to find them yet, but we did want to get on and get the podcast out. And to be honest with you, while it's all salacious and interesting, it's not really what we're trying to do here. We're trying to talk about some of the control points for people if you're working in audit, you know, what to look out for. And I think what we're trying to evidence to audit is that, you know, all these decision-making forums plus all of these conversations, and then there is this, you know, how you communicate with your customers. And it's becoming apparent to me that in 2024, it's no longer acceptable to do what I think you and I, you know, we've been in finance for 30 years. And I think there was an awful lot sort of attitude of, you just tell people something and then the problem kind of goes away. And of course, when we started, there wasn't the paper trail that exists now. You know, there's a real change, isn't there, in our lifetime about what's around, evidentially.
Potentially. A lot of things are digitally recorded, for example.
Absolutely. And yet the culture of the people hasn't really kept in lockstep with that. And they're now starting to find out, and it's a cultural problem. They're starting to realise, or they will realise, that actually things can be uncovered. So you've got to be very clear, I think.
Yes, and if you think about, and we've sort of seen this in another case we've been looking at, that, you know, a decision X may be taken against client Y just because you just have, you know, you just don't really want to get involved. But a salesman will probably then have to explain that in completely different terms as to the reasoning why, actually, look, I'm really sorry, you know, we've hit our capital limits for this or whatever it may be. But as you say, that original conversation may be recorded somewhere. And if that gets out, that's...
I can tell you, Damien, I had a situation where I was in a deposition as a trader and I got presented by the other side's lawyer, ecoms of an event And it was literally 10 minutes after the market shocking event had happened.
Yeah.
And I could, you know, I could see that it was from the salesperson on the desk, and they are ranting and they're saying stuff which I totally understand as a salesperson they do, because their motivation and their loyalty is, of course, it's to the firm, but it's to their customers, their institutional customers. Yeah. And they're kind of ripping about stuff. But in their kind of, you know, everyone in finance at every level, everyone uses leverage. And I'm not talking about, you know, money and four times to one. I'm talking about trying to get things done so they go your way,
yep.
Right? And that's a real part of the kind of the tension inside firms, where people push and, you know, and you navigate a path to get to an outcome.
Work. Yeah, hopefully.
And someone sort of said to me, you know, or I overheard someone saying recently, you know, that if you get to a situation where everyone's kind of angry at you, you've probably achieved the right outcome.
Yes.
You know, you've probably achieved the fair outcome. And I do remember, you know, God rest him, Simon Garcia, who was one of the traders I worked with at Lehman Brothers, no longer with us, sadly. But he used to say that, you know, if all the customers are angry, we're probably making the right price.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that,
yeah.
You know, because they kind of like, you know, and if someone's overly happy and familiar with you, you've really messed up.
You've definitely been taken for a ride.
You've been taken for a ride. So, yeah, sorry, I sort of kind of lost my train of thought on that a little bit. But
yeah, I mean, I think just sort of circling back, the whole point of us having this chat is to kind of think about what it would mean for the control function. It's not really about saying who's right or wrong, and, you know, we are definitely not lawyers and have no particular view at all on that. It'd be interesting to see how things do pan out. But as you said, another thing, we were talking about how we'd be talking about how information might come out from various meetings that have occurred over the past. But also, part of what we've been looking at is the fact that there was no policy or procedure around where this mark was arrived at. And actually, that sort of brings another thing to the fore, which is, you know, should there be? Maybe there's a good reason why there's no policy or procedure in place, because it allows someone to sort of stick their finger in the air and go, we're going to mark them here, we're going to margin them there.
Well, that doesn't sound like a good reason, DT.
No,
pick it up on your language. But I think more to the point is, again, let's put ourselves back in the situation. And it's about, you know, it's the time where you've suddenly had a couple of losses around,
mm-hmm.
through things happening. Probably it wouldn't have occurred, because who on earth, before GameStop, before Archegos, who on earth would be making calls on a, you know, 400% rally from strike, you know, for a relatively safe
retail business? Yeah,
exactly. But of course, in light of, you know, putting ourselves back in this situation with all of the kind of the insanity of COVID, lockdown, illiquidity, people sat at home on furlough with more money than they've ever had in their lives to be able to punt on cryptocurrency and GameStop and everything else, the world has changed.
Mm.
And there is a need. And I wonder whether there's still no policy and procedure. If that is the case, you've got to scratch your head and go ask yourself why.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in control, really?
Mm.
At this point? Given what's happening in this case?
Yeah.
That you really going to turn around to customers and not be able to evidence really why you've done something? You're just saying, suck it up. And the other thing too is the speed at which the demand is made. And of course, yes, everyone's got to be credit worthy, but they actually went for an injunction, didn't they? Frasers Group got an injunction to kind of slow this process down.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think they felt that, you know, they'd offered up all this collateral and nothing had come of it. So they put an injunction in place just to sort of halt proceedings and go, well, what can we do? And as it turns out, they ended up being able to flip the position to another broker to allow them to sit in it without having to collapse the trade, which would have been a very painful outcome for them. So
So they moved it to the Noble House of HSBC. to the Noble House of HSBC. And that cost, didn't it?
Yeah, they reckon $50 million or so.
Which is where the we think this dispute, you know, is focused on, that number.
Yeah.
And of course, that'll be part of the work for the experts to kind of arrive at a quantum and say, well, this is why it costs this money. And that's absolutely standard for this kind of situation. There's been an interesting allegation in the press around the fact that Frasers are alleging, and I don't, it may have come out in the court, I don't know. I haven't seen it in the court papers, I've certainly seen it in the press, that there was an anticipation potentially by Morgan Stanley traders that this would be a disorderly unwind, and therefore they had positioned themselves to profit from this unwind.
Right.
And that's alleging insider trading and front running.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's really you know, an area for investigations and looking at, you know, how they were positioned in anticipation of this occurring.
Yeah, of expected much higher volatility for starters, you'd assume. Yeah.
Well, I think this is interesting because we're dealing with options, and so, you know, with options you've got so many possibilities. You've got the underlying stock itself you can take a position in. You've got CFDs. But then you've got all kinds of strikes,
yep,
all kinds of maturities. And then, of course, you've got the impact on the rest of the sector.
I was about to say, yeah, sector ETFs, all that. You know, there's some really fun stuff you can do that, you know, an obvious position in the underlying would flag, hopefully, pretty fast in systems. But as you say, you know, I don't know, but there may be a German retail ETF of which Hugo Boss is, you know, a significant portion, for example.
Yeah.
So a big movement in that stock would have a knock-on effect through to that ETF, as an example.
And then you've got the challenge inside the bank, because you're on the outside, you're with the law firm, you can't really see inside, of getting to that information, i.e. working out which books this stuff can reside on.
Yeah.
And again, there's a few places, because as we pointed out, it's Germany. So you've got the German stock trader in Frankfurt, presumably. You've got a London book. You've got a London balance sheet. We know that London is a good balance sheet for derivatives. Lots of people use that, you know, for derivatives, for capital usage, etc. So you've got books in London, you've got flow books, you've probably, as you said, you've talking about ETF books as well. And then you've got management books as well. And you also know that there are, you know, there's all kinds of other hedge books around, you know, and joint venture books as well. So that's going to be one that I'm going to be very interested to see whether that makes its way into the main case. Is it leverage, to go back to what we were discussing? Is it, you know, it's an interesting thing in terms of the cases that we have done, that we've looked at Scardi, because I've had a couple of times now where you get presented with a whistleblower alleging some kind of, you know, front running. For me, And obviously this might sound a bit obvious, but quite often what happens is we get a not non-specific, you know, this has happened and this is how it could happen. And someone is really telling you they've got a hunch, and then you investigate it. And I haven't, you know, you don't find evidence. When someone very specifically tells you this is the occasion, you know, they've seen it.
Yeah.
Invariably, that is absolutely correct. But I think what happens in finance, and particularly when you're looking at the outside to, you know, over into where you can't see. So a great example was when I was a trader and what I assumed went on at the interdealer broker when I couldn't explain, you know, movements. And I immediately jumped to all kinds of conclusions. Fast forward to actually when I was sat in the seat at an interdealer broker's, and I was like, oh, I understand why that happened. And but until you sit in that seat, you don't know.
Yeah.
And you make a lot of assumptions. And of course, finance, you make money, you lose money, there's pain, there's pleasure. It causes you to think all kinds of things and assume things. So it'd be interesting to see whether that continues to be a theme for the case. what other aspects could we cover? Well, I think we'd probably just summarise DT. So I think it really what we're saying here is, you know, this is a case where it highlights, you know, the decision-making forums inside financial institutions versus how things are communicated to customers and if there's a difference and the risk that that comes to light. And we've seen in this there are RFIs, requests for information. We know there's freedom of information. There's all kinds of requests now that people are alive to as ways of finding out things that are going on inside institutions without having to go for full kind of disclosure and discovery in a court case. They can just ask for this stuff. So there are ways that this information seems to leak its way out. And then also, of course, you know, this highlights a specific area of risk to do with margin calls and how, you know, even though this is it's seemingly an exchange-traded product, you know, there is a proprietary calculation, if you like, for people's own appetite and exposure and how that's conveyed to customers. And then, you know, back to just the general decisions around acceptance of counterparties and how, you know, those decisions are arrived at, you know, reputationally, and again, evidence to people as well. So it's going to be a fascinating case. I think we should come back after the case has been done and do like a little bit of a moratorium on this.
Yeah, well, there'll be a lot more information obviously will come out. We are basing stuff on press, on some legal announcements as well. But actually, yes, obviously we are partially blind as to exactly what's gone. But it does raise some really interesting points that we thought would be worth sitting down and having a chat about.
Exactly. So, thanks, DT. Really interesting. No Alexandra?
Worries. Thank you so much.
now you know what we've been talking about.
Well, great. Thank you so much for explaining everything in this special episode.
Yeah, we have to come up with a snappy title. Obviously, we can't be a, you know, whatever.
I know.
I'll come up with something.
What was Whit Monday?
Dwayup Nevmatos.
There you go. It just trips off the tongue.
Oh, you'll be able to search that easily.
All right, till next time. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.